Hi, Patrick here. And there are many things in the adult world, terrible things, terrible events, that parents and teachers struggle to explain to kids. Here's a challenge in that department. An earthquake, a tsunami, huge loss of life, a possible nuclear meltdown, the threat of high levels of radiation. How do you explain that? Why, of course, you use language that kids understand. You talk about pooping and farting.
あれは本当に大事故だった。それこそ教室でうんち漏らしちゃった。しかも下痢。しかもそのまま走り回っちゃったぐらいのね。
Lots of Japanese talk in the pod today, as well as a cautionary tale about freedom of expression in France. And nothing says beer like Kate the Great, an old Rasputin, Imperial Russian stouts.
As a free man, I take pride in the word Ich bin ein Berliner.
Why, as an American, do I have to push a button to speak English?
I'm here with Patrick, and it's time to talk words. New words, old words, censoring everything.
This podcast, as well as the World Radio Program, The Big Show, they're both co-productions of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH radio station in Boston. Online, it's all at theworld.org. This podcast is at theworld.org/language, also at patrickcox.wordpress.com. And on Facebook, there's a Facebook page called The World in Words. I'm also on Twitter. My handle is Patrick Cox, PatriCox. On the pod today, we'll start with Japan, some striking words and phrases that are defining the crisis, as well as that kids video that I talked about at the top. And we'll talk cartoons with Carol. Then press freedoms in France, they're being tested as new media investigates where the old media deferred to the powers that be. And then everything you need to know, everything, about Russian imperial stouts made in the US with some great names from Russian history. Okay, so Japan. I saw an essay the other day in the Japan Times. It was written by Kaori Shoji. I'll put a link to it in my blog. And it lists some of the words and phrases that have been on the lips of many Japanese these past few days. Words like, and my usual apology over pronunciations, tensai, heavenly disaster. Also, hinanjo, evacuation facilities. Another word that Kaori Shoji says she's heard a lot is buji. It means safe. And it's made up of two kanji characters. The first is mu, meaning nothing. And the second is koto, meaning incident. Here's the way she puts it. Without incident, it's a state we're all praying for. The word tsunami, of course, is originally Japanese, although now it's a widely used English word as well, much more evocative than any of those other ways of conveying the same or similar meaning. You know, things like seismic tidal wave just doesn't do it. The word in Japanese is a compound of the word for harbor, tsu, and the word for wave, nami. And a little story here delivered via a tweet that I read from reporter Andrew Buncombe. He was in Sendai, covering the devastation for the Independent newspaper. And he was in a restaurant there. He must have been in conversation with the chef, who then asked him, what is the English word for tsunami? Now, the earthquake itself now has a name. Well, it has a couple of names. Geologists in Japan are calling it the Tohoku Chiyo Taiheyo Oki earthquake. That means the Tohoku Area Pacific Ocean Offshore Earthquake, a long, polite name. The U.S. Geological Survey has its own naming convention, which is somewhat different. Brian Atwater is with the survey.
Usually an earthquake name has a year and a place. And at least in English, we try to do it as with a single place name, be it San Francisco or Alaska.
So for this quake, the main area affected was, everyone agrees, Tohoku, the northern part of the Japanese island of Honshu.
So the 2011 Tohoku earthquake captures it.
And that's how it'll be remembered in the history books, in English anyway. Regular listeners to the pod know that cartoon queen Carol Hills does a weekly slideshow on some of the best cartoons around in the non-English-speaking world. Cartoons, of course, have their own syntax and grammar, which often gets the point home quicker than conventional language. It also helps if you're online and your audience doesn't speak the language that you speak. This week, Carol's slideshow is mainly about Japan. Here she is talking about that with The Big Show's Lisa Mullins.
The Japanese flag, for better or for worse, has a red circle in it, the sun. And cartoonists have been morphing that sun, that red disc, into radiation hazard symbols and atomic energy symbols, and having it crying and having it turn into a skull and a mushroom cloud. So the Japanese flag itself has been a big image. There's also images of, they kind of eerily remind you of after the atomic bombs 66 years ago, you know, a parent and child walking through devastation. Other images are guys in hazmat suits, sort of the whole gamut. But they're very moving, and I think cartoonists have really done a great job kind of capturing the feelings of everyone about this disaster.
And the feeling mostly of, it sounds like, sorrow and tragedy. I mean, it's so close to the event itself. Does anyone veer away from that in the cartoons?
Mostly sorrow and tragedy. In one cartoon, the flag, the red disc, has become hands reaching out for help, and some really questioning just how dangerous the situation is around the damaged nuclear reactors.
Carol, you keep your eye on political cartoons around the world. How about outside of Japan? What are the other themes that you're seeing appear?
Well, interestingly, several cartoonists are mixing the Japan story with Libya. There are three or four cartoons that suggest that we're all really focused on the images from Japan, and meanwhile there's this awful thing going on in Libya and the rebels are losing and Gaddafi's forces are brutally killing people. So there's several cartoonists are juxtaposing those two stories and saying we've got to keep looking back at Libya. Mm. Several cartoonists are also commenting on the issue of imposing a no-fly zone over Libya.
And any other cartoon that stood out for you?
Well, what's amazing is some cartoonists have really beautifully captured the beauty of Japan and this horrible tragedy using images, the famous woodcut, Hokusai's woodcut of the Great Wave. Others have used Japanese figures, Japanese people against this horrible backdrop. They've been very tasteful and poignant in how they're really getting at this awful, awful story.
All right. For our listeners who want to check out these cartoons as well, they can go to theworld.org/cartoons. From there, you can also link to our Global Cartoons on Facebook. And on Twitter, you can follow Carol at Global Cartoons. One word. Thanks very much, Carol Hales.
You're welcome, Lisa.
And there's one other thing that Carol passed on to me, an animated video made by a guy called Kazuko Hachia. It tries to explain to children what's going on at the nuclear plant at Fukushima. So it starts off with this character. He's got a very square head, very kid anime look. He's called Nuclear Reactor Boy. Nuclear Reactor Boy has developed bad wind in the aftermath of the earthquake. He's farting a lot. Men in white coats are giving him medication. And what they don't want him to do is to poop, like his friend in Chernobyl did. And if he does poop, they want to make sure his diaper is secure. You get the idea. Now, I should say that this anime is a few days old, and the situation at the nuclear plant has deteriorated. So Kazuko Hachia might not have presented the situation the same way today as he did back then. In any case, I'll post a link to the video. In the last pod, we interviewed our correspondent in Beijing, Mary Kay Magstad, about new restrictions on press freedoms in China, specifically for the foreign press. And just so no one thinks that we on The Big Show were beating up on China or any other non-democratic country, let's consider France. France, of course, is a socially enlightened place, a democracy with a proud constitution that enshrines many, many rights. But something is amiss with press freedom. Or maybe it's just that the French haven't used their press freedoms the way that Americans or Brits or Germans have done, with a tradition of lots of investigative reporting. Now the situation is changing. The tiny but growing number of French journalists who might be described as investigative reporters and editors, well, some of them are running into major trouble from a government that's not used to being investigated. Here's The Big Show's Jerry Haddon in Paris.
Being an investigative reporter in France is a tough, lonely job. Ask Gérard Davet.
Je suis totalement seul ici au journal à faire ce travail-là.
I feel very alone here doing this work, he says. France is different from the U.S. In all of France, at traditional newspapers, there are just five or six investigative reporters. Davet sits alone in a quiet corner of France's second largest daily paper, Le Monde. He's the only investigative journalist on staff, but he's making a lot of waves. Last summer, Davé broke a story implicating French President Nicolas Sarkozy in a scandal involving illegal campaign financing from an earlier election. Davé says his editor sicked him on the story, and Sarkozy sicked the French Secret Service on him.
Quand j'ai sorti ces informations-là dans Le Monde en juillet,
he says President Sarkozy didn't appreciate my report. He ordered his Secret Service to find out who my source was within the Justice Ministry. They investigated the phone records of the person they suspected of being my source, and they found my name, he says, on those records. The Justice Ministry source was demoted and posted overseas.
Je pense que vous vous êtes seulement trompé d'époque. Vous parlez d'un président de la République qui écoutait tout Paris.
The French government has vehemently denied using the Secret Service against Le Monde. Prime Minister François Fillon spoke in the French Parliament last October. He suggested Sarkozy's accusers were paranoid, believing the president was spying on all of Paris. Nevertheless, Le Monde has sued the government for breaking a year-old whistleblower law that protects the secrecy of journalists' sources. The case highlights a relatively new clash of cultures in French society. Davé says traditionally, reporters have granted French leaders wide berth, both personally and professionally.
En France, on a une tradition qui est plutôt une de respect de l'institution publique.
In France, he says, we have a long tradition of respecting authority. When there's a romantic scandal involving a politician, for example, we don't touch it. We just don't care. That's the good side. The bad side is that we've been too deferential, and so politicians feel they can do whatever they want. But that hands-off mentality is rapidly giving way to a new assertiveness, especially in the new media. Take Rue 89, an investigative journalism website. It was launched the day Nicolas Sarkozy won the French presidency in 2007. Rue 89 director Pierre Aski says a year later, the site received and posted this unofficial video of President Sarkozy online.
Vous voulez pas poser une question d'actualité sur Carcassonne, non?
Sur
Carcassonne.
Vous en pensez? Oui, non?
C'est à vous.
D'accord.
Non, c'est à vous.
De toute façon, on en parle à 30, il y a le journal à 30.
D'accord. It's just before an appearance on public TV channel France 3, but the camera is rolling. Sarkozy gets angry when a producer doesn't say hello. Things are going to change around here, he threatens. Sarkozy then tries to suggest topics for the interview that's about to start. In French public broadcasting, threats and suggestions from the president are taken seriously because the outlets are government-funded and the president appoints their directors. And that hardly serves the public good, says journalist David Servenay. Servenay worked for years at the public Radio France Inter, which is funded by the French Foreign Ministry. He says several years ago he was working on stories in Africa, where French businesses have important investments.
I was told by my direction that I should not work anymore on those subjects, without any explanation, which I refused. And I said, okay, if it's like that, I'll quit, you know, the company.
Servenay helped found Rue 89, which, by the way, is being sued by the state for that Sarkozy video, not for defamation, but for theft and counterfeiting. Again, Pierre Aski.
What is really outrageous is the fact that we didn't put a video camera in the bathroom of the Élysée Palace. You know, we didn't steal confidential information about Calabruni or whatever. We took the president in his capacity as president visiting an information network the day France was taking over as president of the EU. So it was a really important moment, and what we showed was completely related to his function as president. So we think we've done our job.
Aski says Rue 89 is defending itself against 5 suits at the moment, and not a week goes by without the threat of another from the public and private sectors. He says it's become a joke, but a costly joke, both in legal fees and in terms of the press's willingness to take risks, says Elsa Vidal of Reporters Without Borders. She says journalists afraid of legal retaliation think twice before investigating possible wrongdoing.
This is the reason why we are underlining the threats those trends are creating for us. You cannot advocate for freedom in Africa, so to speak, or in Russia, if you cannot provide a clear example that that kind of law already exists and that it provides with excellent results.
Reporters Without Borders ranks press freedom around the world each year. France is 41st in 2010, below the European Union average. The French government did not respond to an interview request on the subject, but it recently dodged a bullet in the suit brought by Le Monde for allegedly using counter-espionage agents to find the paper's source. A Paris prosecutor dropped the case, not based on evidence, but because the new law that protects journalist sources has no teeth, no fines, no jail time. In other words, if the government breaks that law, a judge can't mete out punishment. Le Monde is appealing anyway. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon in Paris.
And now, another story from the alcohol desk. Last week, it was Jägermeister, and those crazy names are the Jägermeister mixes that have gone all global. This week, it's Russian beer, or rather, Russian-style beer. Kind of unlikely, I know. Russia's not exactly known for its beer, right? But for more than 200 years, this has existed. Russian Imperial Stout. It was originally brewed not in Russia, but in England. And now that style of beer, that name, is making a comeback here in the United States. The Big Show's Jason Margolis, unlucky guy that he is, spent the whole day in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, chasing down this story. And that's where he discovered a Russian Imperial Stout with its own very memorable name.
The big event of the year at Portsmouth's best-known brew pub, the Portsmouth Brewery, is Kate Day. That's when they offer visitors the chance to drink their Kate the Great beer. Kate is the 18th century Russian Tsarina Catherine the Great. About 200 people have lined up in the freezing rain. At the very front is John Anastas and his uncle. They arrived the night before.
We took two of these chairs, and we took umbrellas, and we made like a makeshift tent.
They had on-off sleep. Not a hardship for them to taste a beer that's only available once a year. Inside the pub, I asked brewmaster Todd Mott about that, the once-a-year thing.
I think it keeps it special. I think it keeps people, you know, guessing what it's going to be like this year, and it enables us to keep that sort of that, you know, oh, I'm going to get one this year, alive.
Russian Imperial Stout is a very dark beer, similar to Guinness, but richer. It also has a much higher alcohol content, about 10-12%. I asked Todd Mott why that is.
In Russia, which the beer was designed for, they were drinking a good amount of vodka, and they need something to keep, you know, sort of in cahoots with the vodka. And so this big black burly stout was made in England and exported to Russia during Catherine the Great's reign. And they were drinking massive quantities of Imperial Stout, apparently.
Mott says he brews his version of the stout once a year because the whole process takes 5 months. Once tapped, the beer is gone in a matter of hours. Still, it's worth making. Kate the Great was ranked as the second best beer on the planet by Beer Advocate magazine. Most of the people I met at Kate Day were bushy-bearded New Englanders. New Hampshire doesn't have many Russians. But working at the brewery is Olga Safronyuk, who's from Siberia. She says this mania for Russian stouts definitely doesn't happen back home.
Actually, I never heard about Russian Imperial Stout before. The first time I tried it was yesterday.
Safronyuk finds the Russian beer mania a bit bizarre, but she says, why not?
I'm proud. The people remember about Russia, remember about Russian history.
Several other American breweries have also started making Russian stouts. Among the first was the North Coast Brewing Company in Fort Bragg, California. Its Old Rasputin Stout debuted 15 years ago. Doug Moody with the company says they wanted a label to catch people's eyes. I asked if using a crazed picture of Rasputin, the so-called Mad Monk, does that.
Of course it does. Of course it does. And, you know, and it wasn't an accident. The story of Rasputin lent itself perfectly to this beer.
The story of Rasputin is that of perhaps one of the most bizarre, perplexing humans ever to roam the earth. And there are stories about Catherine the Great, too. When the brewmaster in Portsmouth finally tapped the Kate the Great keg, I was expecting bedlam. It felt more like center court at Wimbledon. The beer drinkers here just weren't party animals. These folks were burrowing their noses deep into their glasses and debating aromas.
It's very nice. It's smooth.
This is John Anastas, the man from the front of the line.
You get a lot of dark chocolate, hint of plum, like he was saying. But the big thing is it's just so balanced.
I, too, ordered a glass of Kate the Great. I'm not quite ready to stand in the rain for 11 hours for a taste of it, or even one. But I have to say, after a glass, I got the hype. I was really surprised at just how much I liked it. It was indeed phenomenal for the world. I'm Jason Margolis.
Okay, that's it for this week. Give me your feedback on Twitter, Facebook, or theworld.org/language. Or you can email me. The address is language@pri.org. See you next week.